Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Attention, attention. Hello there, listeners. It's We Have Ways of Making You Chalk, another one of our Chalk Valley We Have Ways of Making You Talk crossovers. The Avengers films have nothing on this for sheer crossover power, do they, James?
No, absolutely not.
We've combined our podcast with your history festival and pun carrying all the weight, the load-bearing.
It's amazing,
pun,
isn't it? It's amazing what can be done, what can be achieved. And actually,
with one word.
While I think about it, because I forgot the other day, can I just puff the Chalk Valley History Show, which is also going on every night at 7:30 p.m. live. And tonight, Thursday the 25th of June, the main talk on the show is Adam Rutherford, the brilliant Adam Rutherford, talking about how to argue a racist. You're on as well with your Spitfire wing spar bit. Laura Maitland. And we've got Annette Gordon-Reed from the US and Tom Timbrell, who's doing his Iron Age Forge. So lots going on tonight. So do have a look at that. And you can get that at cvhf.org.uk. And it's on. There's a link straight through to YouTube Premiere at 7:30 p.m. tonight. So that's cvhf.org.uk.
cvhf.org.uk to see me blather on about a piece of aluminium. I mean, there's other items, obviously. Right, now.
But nothing as important as that, obviously.
Right, now, listeners. Hello there, everybody. This is I've been looking forward to this for ages and to getting this chap on to talk to us at some point. We are talking today to Professor Gary Sheffield from the Department of War Studies at the University of Wolverhampton, and author of such books as Forgotten Victory, The First World War, Myths and Realities, a book that basically upset all the right people, I think is one of the ways of looking at it.
Yeah.
Broke an awful lot of crockery in the process. A biography of Earl Douglas Haig in 2011, and someone who has made colossal waves in the study of the First World War and trying to crack open public attitudes and received opinions on the First World War, but who is now moving his sights in our direction, James.
Yes, except like all super duper eminent academic historians like Gary, their knowledge is wide, and that's one of the things that always makes talking to people like Gary so interesting, because you know you're going to get that broader perspective, that broader spectrum. And you know, this being We Have Ways of Making You Chalk, we want to do that big picture stuff, and I've you know, we've just been reading an article that you've sent us, Gary, which is certainly much broader than I'd originally kind of thought about all this stuff. But anyway, it's great to have you on, so thank you for coming.
Yes, hello. So hello, Gary. Now
hello.
Hello. Now yeah,
you are allowed to speak.
One of the things that comes up. Yes,
yeah. That's good. Yeah, yeah.
Blabbering on.
Didn't want to interrupt your flow.
Well, no, we were singing your praises, of course. One of the things that comes up every now and again when people talk about the Second World War and the 20th century is this idea of a 30 years war, a second 30 years war. Because it kind of fits, doesn't it? You know, the 30 years war, the colossal confrontation of the 17th century that spanned the whole of Europe, vast amounts of people killed, Germany shattered, or the German state shattered by it, Sweden overturned. It happened here as well, if you include the English Civil War, and so on. But what do you make of this idea of a 20th century 30s war? Because it's neat. It's neat, isn't it?
Well,
it fits.
It is very neat. And in some ways, it works really well. Because from our perspective, it's easy to look back and see, right, there's this, in effect, the argument is there's a European Civil War.
Yeah.
It breaks out in 1914. The first phase of it ends in 1918. And there's a lot of unresolved problems and the peace isn't very satisfactory. And, you know, they come back and start all over again 20-odd years later. Of course, famously, Marshal Foch, the Allied sort of Supreme Commander in 1918, said of the Treaty of Versailles that this isn't a peace, it's a 20-years armistice. And he was pretty well right, bearing in mind he was speaking in 1919. And so in some ways it fits really well. In other ways it doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the big things which comes and sort of slaps you between the eyes, the moment you start to sort of read round the literature of the last sort of 20-odd years, is that actually there's no reason why the Treaty of Versailles shouldn't actually have succeeded. That actually it's not the world's greatest peace treaty, but, you know, which one is.
Yep.
And actually, if everybody had been prepared to get behind it, it might have worked. By everybody, I really mean the victor powers. You know, the Britain, France, the United States in particular. Trouble is, two out of the three of those peeled off really quickly. The French were keen on imposing, you know, making sure that the Germans stuck to the letter of the Treaty of Versailles. But their two sort of erstwhile allies cleared off. So actually, that's the first thing. The second thing is that this has almost become orthodoxy over the last few years. The really big breaking point at which war becomes inevitable a second time. It's not as far back as Versailles in 1919. It's really the Wall Street crash, which in 1929, which brings about the Great Depression, which hits Europe with full force in 1930, 31, 32. That destroys the already pretty rickety Weimar Republic in Germany, which of course is starts off as a democracy, has a very, very difficult birth in revolution, mm-hmm. but is stabilised by the late 20s and actually gets really badly hit by this.
Yeah.
And that produces the circumstances under which Hitler comes to power. Now, anybody who's looked into how Hitler comes to power realises there's nothing preordained about it. In some ways, it's some German conservatives trying to be clever by putting him into power, therefore to clip his wings and the rest of it. And of course, Hitler, once in power, once in office, I should say, seizes power. There's a revolution and you have the Nazi state emerging. But even up to a point, you know, well, revolutions happen left, right and centre, but Hitler is such a one-off, a dedicated fanatic, racist and all the rest of it. Well, lots of those around, but actually he was determined a war on a global scale from the very beginning. And it's easy to imagine that history goes pretty well according to as it did in reality, and you have some sort of military figure emerging as a dictator in the early 30s, and you might get some sort of small-scale border war with Poland in 1939. What you actually got was this vast racial, genocidal, ideological war, and that's Hitler's doing. So,
but Gary, I think it's worth pointing out, isn't it, that you know, I think because we live in such interesting times at the moment, you know, the interesting thing about is why is it the Wall Street crash? And it's the Wall Street crash because you have this incredible economic downturn, and what you get when you have incredible economic downturns is you then get political unrest follows, you know, as sure as sort of, you know, day follows night. And the old order changeth, doesn't it? And suddenly you've got, you know, people are getting angry and they want an outlet for it. And, you know, you can see these patterns repeating themselves over and over through history and not least at the moment. It's really interesting, isn't it?
Well, you could see some of the same things. I'm a bit dubious about sort of extrapolating from the past to the present. I am a historian, after all. That's not the sort of thing that gets you criticised on Twitter if you make sort of two direct parallels. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the circumstances we're going through now are...
It's the patterns. I'm not saying it's the history repeats itself. It's the patterns.
Well, and what happens is ideas that have been lurking on the fringes take on new impetus, don't they? It's the thing, because people are angry. They're looking for answers. They feel desperate. So actually, actors that have previously been regarded as irrational or not an option, which is exactly what happens in Germany, isn't it? But as you say, Gary, had the nothing's ordained about Hitler's arrival in power, because he takes office and then, as you point out, then takes power, because you've had plenty of people in Germany in office who haven't really been in power, which has sort of been the gap.
Well, there's an election in July 1932, isn't there? And, you know, he comes into power in January 19, you know, it's 6 months later, isn't it?
At which point the Nazi vote had actually dropped.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely right. I mean, you see all of these things going on at this time, and as well as ideas coming from the margin. Of course, some of them are actually, you know, inverted commas, good ideas. In the US, you know, the United States is going through absolute traumatic economic problems in the early 30s, and it throws up a charismatic radical leader, but it's FDR.
It's
Roosevelt, who actually does come up with some things which would have been regarded as being, you know, completely beyond the pale just a few years before, you know, the whole New Deal and all the rest of it. I know you had Dan Todman on a few weeks ago, and he's very keen on this idea that Britain in the 30s, I think, is stable, not least because you've already got a sort of liberal version of Toryism in place, particularly under Baldwin. Chamberlain's a much more divisive Marmite figure, but Baldwin's the key guy in power at the early stage. And so, you know, you don't have the sort of political space for a rabble-rousing radical. I mean, Oswald Mosley, you know, is the obvious example, who clearly wanted to come to power. France, of course, you have enormous political stability, instability, and what happens is that democracy survives, but the French state, I think, is greatly weak. And of course, 1940 and Pétain, the National Revolution, all that happens. So all of these things, there's a range of things which happen because of the instability in the 30s. Back to my original point, it's by no means predetermined that the First World War, slightly dodgy peace, Second World War breaks out 20 years later, do not pass go, do not collect 200, all sorts of things. Old age A.P. Taylor, of course, I suspect we're all brought up on him.
Do you think it is? I mean, there's so much upheaval, though, in the 1930s, isn't there? You know, there's Piers Brenda's Dark Valley. He sort of looks into all this kind of forensically. And, you know, all these, I mean, from the upheaval in Japan to China to, you know, to political changes of, you know, we talk about France, but, you know, huge number of different governments in France, you know, very unstable politically at the time. You know, the economic downturn of 1929, is that also is that a hangover of 1914 to 18, do you think, in Versailles? Or is that overstating it?
Well, the last thing I would claim to be is an economic historian. But no, it strikes me that what happens, of course, is the world economic order is given enormous shock by the First World War. And so already there's a good deal of instability in the system in the 20s. So in Britain, of course, you know, you have, you know, persistently high unemployment from, you know, the early 20s onwards. Mm. It simply gets worse in the Depression.
Because the general strike is 3 years, the general strike of 1926 is 3 years before.
Absolutely. And there's an argument, actually, that the general strike shows this central stability of British society rather than the opposite. Yeah. Because the trade union, well, basically, most of the trade unions and the government cooperate to keep the lid on everything. Yeah. So, you know, it's very different from Germany just a few years later or a few years earlier. So all of these things are in the mix. So, but it was a very volatile situation. And the Great War really rips everything up and makes everything new. Because certainly when I was, when I was at school, when I was a student at university a very long time ago now, there was sort of general assumption that the Second World War was the point at which everything changed. Actually, no. The world the Second World War destroys is barely 30 years old, because actually the old order, where you have the Habsburg Empire, which has been there for however many hundred years and what have you. That's the stability, which is destroyed by the First World War. So back to Al's original question for about 3 hours ago now. Strikes me that the 30 Years War thesis actually makes a lot of sense, because clearly we're in a really big period of stability, which lasts from 1914, arguably a few years before, to 1945, definitely a few years after. But there's a sort of, sake of argument, a 40-year block of instability and crisis, right, of which the two world wars are at the centre of it. But that doesn't mean that the First World War absolutely causes the Second World War, or rather the ending of the First World War doesn't cause the Second World War. Another way out of it is certainly possible, even be a small-scale war in 1939, but not on the scale of the one we get.
But is the thing that's not remarkable about the 20th century, though, is that, and I'm you're going to argue with this proposition, is that this is the first time populations are mobilised fully. That this is the first proper, you know, this is how we see it from here. That because people aren't in touch with what happened in, particularly in this country, aren't really in touch with the European mobilizations and the way, for instance, the Napoleonic Wars were fought in Europe. That there's this idea that these are the first total wars, wars of populations, wars of citizens, wars of governments, and rather than wars of states, rather than crowns and their military castes, if you will. And but that isn't the case, is it? The Napoleonic War is a citizen state. You know, the French Revolution generates the idea of the citizen soldier, the relationship between the soldier, the citizen, and in fact all the things that in the Second World War the British state uses in order to mobilize its population, that you're a citizen, so you're doing your bit to help everyone else out. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, like everything in history, you get two historians together and you get about 45 opinions. And total war is actually quite controversial. But I actually think it's a really good way of understanding the way that wars operate and actually how societies cope with wars. If you regard total war as being, we mentioned the 30 Years' War, the 17th century, just killing lots of people. Well, that's happened many times before.
Yes.
What's different from 1792, the outbreak of the Revolutionary Wars, becomes the Napoleonic Wars, is that you get a very deliberate attempt, first of all by the French and then by everybody else, to mobilise populations in a way which they haven't really been able to do before. And I think there's two reasons. The first one is, it's about ideas. The idea that the Battle of Valmy, you know, the famous example in 1792, when the Prussians, you know, the army which had been of Frederick the Great and was still supposedly the greatest army in Europe, gets turned away in actually a pretty small scale battle at Valmy by a bunch of sort of, you know, ragged French revolutionaries. Well, why is that? Well, all sorts of reasons, but one of them is that this is mobilising people who are now citizens and not subjects. They are fighting because they have a stake in the state they're defending, and that's new.
So they've suddenly got skin in the game in a way that they haven't before.
Absolutely, yeah. And if you accept that you're no longer sort of a peasant and a subject of a king, you are a citizen, and therefore you have certain privileges. You also have certain responsibilities, the key one of which is to defend the state.
But that also, presumably it's also morale. And, you know, Al and I have spent an awful lot of time talking about the importance of morale in the Second World War. But, you know, any army, if it's got no morale, it's kind of very difficult to kind of motivate people. And if you're doing it because you're, you know, you've been told to by your king or by your knight or you're, you know, you're just a serf, then, you know, as you say, you've got no skin in it, have you? But if you're suddenly a citizen and you're fighting for sort of a bigger ideal, then you're more motivated, aren't you? Motivation is really important.
Well, it's absolutely critically important, and the French score really, really well on this, actually for much of the period we're talking about, right down to 1815, because they regard themselves as actually having a stake in what they're fighting for. Now, if you're a peasant called up for the Prussian army or the Russian army or the Austrian army, conceivably you haven't actually got that, well, you probably haven't got that sense. Brits, as always, are different, of course, because the British Army is a regular professional army, very largely, and they might not have a stake in the system, but actually they're well disciplined and all the rest of it. One of the big differences, though, of course, is that as the Napoleonic Wars wear on, the other side catch on to the importance of nationalism. So the Prussians in 1813, the Russians in 1812, the Spanish fighting the alongside the Duke of Wellington against the French in the peninsula. And of course, today is the 205th anniversary, is that right, of Waterloo? So, and De Gaulle's speech. Yeah, I noticed that the Waterloo wasn't mentioned on the BBC News today when Macron came over, oddly. But the Spanish, of course, make a really big thing of, you know, you're fighting for king and country. And religion, it's a different form of nationalism from the French nationalism, but it's really, really potent. And of course, you get that in spades. If I just finish the point, because I think it ties in really neatly to what you said about the Second World War. The other big difference is that in the late 18th century, so 1790s onwards, the state's inability to do something about channeling this nationalism in a way it really hasn't before. And this becomes even more potent as the 19th century wears on, and of course into the 20th century. So by the time of the First World War, you actually have nationalism pretty well in all countries, including, you know, the Habsburg Empire. And we're able to tap into that because you've got conscription, which is pretty rigorously reinforced. Not least because actually, if you want to run away and hide in your granny's tool shed, you know, in 1800, you probably can. It's much more difficult to do that because the grip of the state has increased 100 years later. It's also probably, you know, seen as being a real social downer if you're a column dodger, draft dodger 100 years later, where it wasn't before. Even more so in the First World War, even more so in the Second World War. And of course, I'm not sure whether you've had Johnny Fennell on to talk about his brilliant book, The People's Fighting the People's War. And this comes out in spades. Motivation, citizenship, and all the rest of it for the British and Dominion armies and the Indian Army in the Second World War.
Because this is one of the interesting things, isn't it, about the 19th century, is that nationalism is really a product of the French Revolution, and for a long time during the 19th century is essentially a progressive idea. It's a new idea because it's getting rid of the idea of kings and subjects and repositioning the citizen and inventing the state. And so in the 19th, so then when Nazism come along, Hitlerism, but basically taking those clothes, it's one of these, you know, snakes and ladders of history thing, that nationalism, which comes from a revolutionary place, you know, from arguably from the left, ends up in the hands of people certainly on the right, and sort of nationalism's traverse across the political spectrum is pretty interesting. And then the state, you know, the politicians using it and then backing away from it because it's such a potent force. It's a fascinating part of its
absolutely,
progress.
Absolutely, because, you know, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the monarchical powers, the old regimes who've won, they want to stuff the nationalist genie back in the bottle.
Yes. Yeah, and it doesn't work, does it? It doesn't work at all. You suddenly get that movement in Italy, which develops after the Napoleonic Wars, to kind of the push for unification, kick out the Habsburgs. You know, what do we want the Habsburgs in Italy? You know, and that eventually sees its end in 1861, of course, with the Risorgimento. But you know, you have the revolutions of 1848. You've got all sorts of stuff going on.
Absolutely,
you know,
and
the message is, you know, we the people want to kind of take back control.
That's a phrase.
We're just on that very thought. We will take a break and we'll be back with Gary Sheffield in a minute because I need to take back control of this podcast. See you in a tick.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Chalk.
Sorry about
what a
that.
Thought
it
to
just
end,
suddenly
what
came
a thought to,
me.
To end on. Well, no, but it's this is the thing. This is the interesting thing, and it is interesting the way that nationalism has made its way across the political spectrum. I remember John Keegan writing about this very interestingly about Prussian citizenship and rifle clubs in Germany, in German provinces, where people would join up to be riflemen, and then you did your military service, and that way you got the vote.
Right.
And that, you know, and so you could, so there's sort of an argument that that when you get universal suffrage after the First World War in this country, it's the people of Britain being told, thank you for your service, well done, you turned up when we needed you to as riflemen, so now we're going to give you the vote. I mean, that's not actually I think not far off at what happened, really.
Well, it's absolutely right. I mean, there is a sense that the working classes are mostly disenfranchised. They're actually forming the bulk of the armies in the First World War. Therefore, they must be rewarded. And actually, I think people lost sight of this 2 years ago when we were commemorating the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. That actually was, in many ways, an add-on to giving male working classes a vote. Yeah. But actually, spooling back a bit before the war, the British Dominions, particularly New Zealand and Australia, had already brought in universal suffrage before the war. And one of the reasons for that is, you know, there's this sense that they've proved willing to defend the country and the empire, therefore that must be rewarded. So there's a real sense, you know, why citizen soldier, which actually happens when I'm writing about at the moment, is important out in the Dominions, because it shows your Brits abroad, you're actually worthy of self-government, and because these places tend to be a bit more democratic than Britain were at that stage, the vote came along early. So, yeah. And again, we forget that, you know, the current British political system is barely 100 years old in terms of universal suffrage and all the rest of it. Mm. We're talking about a really recent phenomenon in historical terms.
Yeah, which after all, and again, Jonathan Fennell talks about this, and other authors like Ben Kite and Alan Allport, that the idea that the Second World War Army is a different prospect to the First World War Army, because they're voters. It's a completely different, literally a different constituency that the generals are dealing with. They're dealing with people who live in constituencies all of a sudden, and who have a say.
And that's absolutely right. And generally, anyway, they're a more bolshy lot than their fathers and uncles and elder brothers. In fact, the amount of social change between 1918 and 1939, I think, is really underrated. That on the surface, you've got the same sort of army trotting out in 1914 as in 1939. Actually, you haven't. I mean, they think differently. It's 20 years into a sort of democratic experiment. And
they're not quite as deferential, are they?
They're not nearly as deferential. And one of the things which... flying off a tangent here, what I've been working on recently, is I think the British officers...
Tangent away, we like that.
the British officers in the First World War, I think, are very, very good at actually recognising what their men need in terms of paternal leadership. Officers of the Second World War, oddly, really they're not. And I think they're taken by surprise by how the nature of the soldiers they're being faced with, who after all are the sons of the blokes that, you know, the generals are commanding as captains and majors 20 years before, they actually have a really quite a different outlook on life. And again, this is all wrapped up to this idea of huge change, you know, ripping up in 1914, and they still haven't entirely reassembled the bits in the right order in 1939.
Yeah, I mean, and the army, because the army are keenly aware of this, aren't they? They're sensitive to this idea. You've also got that thing where the generals think, well, I can't ask them to do the things we ask their fathers to do. They'll just say no. They're too bolshy. They'll tell us to get knotted. And you also, and it's a thing in letters home an awful lot, especially in Normandy, you've got people saying, well, at least it's not as bad as it was for my dad on the Somme. I know things are bad here. You know, and when we talked about Normandy a lot, about the meat grinder in Normandy that it descends into, and they're right, they're all saying to each other, well, it's not as bad as what my dad had to put up with, and it arguably really.
Well,
really
do you know
is.
What? I remember really clearly talking to this lovely chap called Peter Moore, who was in the Leicesters,
And he fought in Tunisia, and then he fought. He was wounded at Salerno, came back, and then fought on the Gothic Line battles on the with 8th Army on the eastern side of Italy. And he shared with me this letter that he'd sent to his parents, saying exactly that. He said, "I'm read," and it was a line where he said, "I'm reading Memoirs of an Infantry Officer at the moment by Siegfried Sassoon to remind myself that however bad it is, it wasn't as bad as it was in the Western Front." And I said to him. Exactly your point, Al. I said, actually, it was worse. And I said, just think about it. Think about all the letters you sent before. You know, my friend from school, Johnny, I've just heard that he's died. Phil has just died. Bob didn't make it. You know, essentially all his mates get killed. I think I had to be something like 35 combat veterans of the Italian campaign. And of all those veterans, there was only one who hadn't been wounded or badly so.
Well, I mean, it was just amazing. That's so right. I mean, the first thing I ever had published on the Second World War, first thing I own up to anyway, was a chapter in a book called Paul Anderson and Angus.
Time
to Kill.
Yes,
Time,
I've got
Time
to
Kill.
I've got just up here.
And I did a chapter called The Shadow of the Somme, and I basically just made that argument that all these guys in the Second World War consoled themselves by, no matter how horrible it was, that their dads had it worse. So, well, actually, no. Normandy, Cassino, Chinditz.
Yeah.
They had a really, really bad time. That's the one. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You can't see it, but I'm holding it up.
Shadow of the Somme by G.D. Sheffield. It's when I still use my initials until I was told to start using my first name because it's more useful.
Oh, you'll be pleased to know you've got a tick there, Gary.
Ah, you actually read it. but it's so important because I think that the soldiers of the Second World War mythologized their dad's war to make sense of their own one.
Yeah.
And I think someone in that book made the point, I can't remember who it was, might be John Ellis actually, that particularly the infantrymen, they had, you know, conceivably an even worse time than the Second World, the First World War predecessors, because the vast majority of British soldiers in the Second World War were on the lines of communications, or they were doing something. And what are we talking about? Was it 15% of all soldiers in Normandy were actually in rifle companies, and they took 75% of the casualties?
Actually 14%. Yeah, I mean, but that's interesting. That's the difference between the First World War and the Second World War, is that the proportion of those who are really right at the sharp end is much less. You know, so, you know, the makeup of Second Army in Normandy is 43% in the service corps. We don't have anything like that number in the First World War.
So
I think it's only 8% in tanks. Whereas, you know, everything that we write about, whether it be a commando comic, whether it be a film, Saving Private Ryan, whether it be a narrative history, a documentary, all we focus on is the 14% in the infantry and the 8% in tanks. So it gives this impression that they make up kind of 90% of the army, when actually they, collective, they make up only 22%, and it is very, very distorting.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right. It's not original thought, and again, I can't remember who said it, but why don't we have our vision of the Second World War shaped by the same sort of things we have our vision of the First World War? Well, because you don't get this mass of sort of really grim memoirs. I mean, you do get grim memoirs from the Second World War, but most people are writing about their war as being, you know, very different from, you know, the infantryman's experience. And so, things like Martin Lindsay's So Few Got Through, or Sidney Jarry's 18 Platoon, they're not nearly as well known as they should be in comparison to, I guess, their First World War equivalents, because...
Well, in the case of Sidney Jarry, I mean, the reason is because he refused to publish it properly. He only wanted to do it for raise money for his regiment, which then became the the Light Infantry Regiment in Dorchester. And he still refuses to have it published, anything other than self-published. I mean, you know, someone could get hold of that and turn that into an absolute classic. But you know, I've just been talking to Christopher about this, and you know, that was his father's dying wishes.
I actually knew Sidney relatively well, because he would come along every turn to talk to the cadets at Sandhurst.
Yeah, because he's an absolute legend,
isn't he? Over a few munches and whatever. And actually, that book, I think, has had an amazing impact on a couple of generations of army officers, went through Sandhurst from the late 80s onwards.
Yeah, it has, but it is literally, because it's sort of taught as a set text at Sandhurst.
Yeah.
But it is not
It is not widely known. And for anyone who can get hold of a copy, I mean, I couldn't recommend it more highly. It's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant account. But it's interesting, you know, you go to Normandy, and I think that, you know, if you add up all the casualties and divide it by the days of the battle, the 77 days, you get a figure of, off the top of my head, it's like 6,780, which is actually a higher daily casualty rate than the Somme, Passchendaele or Verdun. But it's, you know, but the proportions of people at the coalface is obviously less than it was in the First World War. But if you're a frontline soldier in the Second World War, your chances of getting through unscathed are literally zip.
Can I sort of drag this back to 30 Years' War feast?
Yeah, of course. That's exactly how we like to do things.
The point is, I think that where the 30 Years' War does work as an idea is you see the Second World War in terms of tactics and very largely technology as well as being more of and better than 1418 rather than completely invented from scratch.
Yeah,
right.
And certainly, and I think it's really interesting because you find Second World War vets, Sidney Jarry being one of them actually, being quite sniffy about First World War veterans. So of course these old farts, as far as they're concerned, you know, with these outdated methods. Actually, you look at what they're doing in 1918.
It's not much different.
It's not much difference. It really there isn't. But of course, also,
If you look at the battle plan for Alamein, I mean that you know, it's huge artillery barrage advance. I mean, there's not
a lot of difference from.
So
from,
if
from
you
the,
added
the
up,
First World War, but the difference is, of course, is they can all communicate with one another.
So if you added up, that's
the big difference.
So if you added up to 10 years in total fighting, you basically spend half of it fighting like the first 3 years, the First World War, and half of it fighting like the Second World War, if you want, because I mean that's what the friendship. You know, this idea that the Germans fight World War II, the French fight World War I in May 1940, that there's this sort of, that the penny has dropped for some and not for others is what, another part of the story, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And actually, I think that's a bit unfair on the French, because
the French thought
really hard about the lessons of the First World War and came up with precisely the wrong ones. if you actually look at the rationale behind, you know, the conducted battle and all the rest of it for 1940... In 1916 terms, it makes a certain amount of sense. But of course, they haven't really caught up with the broader thinking. The Germans, of course, the other hand, of course, you know, get huge admiration for what they did. In fact, they also drew effectively the wrong lessons. They come together with, you know, debate this term Blitzkrieg, which works when it works, but then basically, I think, is a false form of warfare.
But Gary, that's how the Germans have always fought. I mean, you know, that's how Frederick the Great fought. It's this idea that you know, because they're resource poor, you know, because they're stuck in the middle of Europe, they've, you know, whatever battle they've got to be, that they're going to fight, it's got to be fought quickly, because otherwise they're going to be stuffed. The moment it comes, gets drawn out and attritional, they're in the doo-doo. And so that's sort of as old as the hills for the Prussians than the Germans. I mean, there's nothing new at all. It's just that in 1914, they get bogged down and ultimately so they do in the Second World War too.
Well, absolutely is. I mean, the difference is that this time people take it seriously. I mean, on the other side, I mean, you know, I've been listening to some of the stuff coming out about Normandy recently. And of course, the British make, again, a really wrong decision in 1940, 41, 42. What the Germans have are lots and lots of tanks. That's the key to their success. Therefore, we need lots and lots and lots of tanks, which we end up with lots and lots of tanks and not enough infantry in 1944. And we haven't really worked out the correct way to use tanks and. So all of these things, I think, are... They're understandable spin-offs from the lessons of the First World War, which then lead on to what happened in the beginning of the Second World War. But it really takes, wise... very egocentric head on the shoulders of Bernard Montgomery to come up with, I don't know, what we do at Alamein is go back to what I learned as a staff officer in 1917 at the Battle of Messines. We'll have a nice sort of set piece offensive, lots of artillery. But Big Monty, of course, he would never own up to where he got his inspiration from. And again, in 1944, and of course, separately in the Mediterranean in 43, 44, you have the British Army coming up with combined arms tactics, which are really well known in 1918, but for all sorts of reasons been forgotten or at least neglected, and you have to put them all back together again. So, yeah, I think the Second World War, treating the First and Second World War as being two, you know, linked conflicts in terms of technology and tactics and methods, I think makes a huge amount of sense. So this idea of, I think, the 30 Years' War actually does work quite well in that respect.
In that regard. And then, of course, the advent of nuclear weapons just means it's all changed. That's all, that era has ended as well, that era of that form of total war, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, no one who wasn't in the know about the Manhattan Project in July 1945 would have believed that they had just fought the last global conventional total war, because they had had, you know, two within the space of 20 years. A third one was going to be clear on the cards at some point in the future. But of course, what happens is the invention of nuclear weapons suddenly makes conventional warfare much too dangerous to contemplate. Well, actually, of course, the Americans did contemplate it in the late 40s, early 50s. Yeah. But realistically, it makes the whole thing far too dangerous. So therefore, it's not that war ceases to exist, as some sort of, you know, quite optimistic thinkers thought in the late 40s. It merely means that sort of war no longer exists. So therefore, you have things like Korea, which is pretty much a Second World War, even First World War being fought conventionally, but the war is not allowed to boil. So warfare does change. It basically means that you never fight total war like the First or Second World Wars again.
And everything kind of since then really has been asymmetric in its prosecution, hasn't it? So it has.
And also weaponry's just become too sophisticated.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. So Korea, Vietnam, and Afghanistan, all the wars in Afghanistan tend to be superpower not picking on someone its own size, because picking on someone your own size is just not worth the candle.
Well, just think about air power. That's right. Yep. I mean, you know, how many jets are there in Europe at the moment? Well, let's say, for argument's sake, about 170, something like that. So what happens once you know, so for argument's sake, it's kind of, you know, NATO countries against Russia. You know, what happens once those jets get knocked out of the sky? I mean, because inevitably there will be some attrition. I mean, you can't build 296 a month or 496 a month, can you? You build one every 6 months.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was working for the army, you know, back when I was teaching at Sandhurst in the 90s, one of my students told me, and I still don't know whether it's true or not, it might have been a wind-up, they're very prone to winding up their lecturers, that there were a load of the old, you know, the Conqueror tanks from the 1960s, those sort of Goliath things, in giant plastic bags in store somewhere. In an old railway tunnel near Bath, I think it was told, which would be wheeled out once all the decent tanks have been destroyed on the Central Front if the Soviets attacked.
With the RAF, you'll have to sort of, you know, unstrap the gate guardians and fire them up and bring back the tornado.
I find that entirely believable, to be honest. mothballed tanks and so on. Gary, one of the interesting things, isn't it, to go back to what we were originally trying to talk about, is that of course a thing like the First World War, Second World War, as they go further away in time, it's perhaps easier to you know, bracket them together, isn't it? Whereas when they're up close, it's the tumble of history of one thing happening after another. And is it the historian's temptation to say, oh well, you know, I can give these a label now and explain them with an overarching label? Because right at the start, you did say after all, if German conservatives had found a different way of dealing with Hitler politically, we'd be talking about the First World War and then whatever happened in the 50s, you know, when the, you know what I mean? So to go back to I digress from my own point, is this not like a historian's temptation to sort of say, here's the thing, because the echo with the 30 Years War is almost irresistible, or is this actually how patterns emerge, like James said earlier?
It's a bit of bit of both things, actually, because certainly from the late 1890s onwards, there was a sense, I think it might have been at Moltke the Elder, who made a comment that, you know, the next war that start will be a 30 years war because of the strength of the states involved and what have you. So there was actually a sense running alongside the idea that the next war would be short, which actually I'm far from sure was a universal belief among decision makers, that actually you're letting yourself in for something really nasty if you let the genie out of the bottle. The other thing, of course, is that historians, you're absolutely right, do like to sort of play around with stuff like this. I can't remember who said it, but said there's two sorts of historians. There's lumpers and splitters. The lumpers like to put things together to form patterns. The splitters like to sort of clear them off to find clear blue water.
Great line.
Are you a lumper or a splitter, Jim?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
I think I'm a lumper, actually.
You think you're a lumper?
There we go.
We're nearly turning into an Oompa Loompa, which is not quite the same thing at all. But certainly, I think if you're in the 1920s, to be told or at least hinted at that this might not be the end of it is really shocking. Colonel Repington, who was the military correspondent, first of all, the Times and the Morning Post, terrible reprobate and all-round cad. He published in 1920... two volumes of memoirs, which caused a scandal, not least because he was recounting, diaries, not memoirs. He was recounting conversations he'd had with people only sort of 18 months before. Oh, I sat down with Winston. Winston said such and such. That's very shocking if you're involved. But the real reason why it caused a scandal was he called these memoirs the First World War. In 1920, he was implying there was going to be another one. And that was not a popular message.
No.
In the 1920s. And of course, for most of the interwar period, they didn't actually call it the First World War, World War I. It was the war, the Great War, the European War. There was a piece by, I think it's David Reynolds, a few years ago, who looked into the politics of what you call wars.
Yeah.
And so Churchill, I seem to remember in the first volume of... his Second World War volumes, that the Gathering Storm makes a big thing about, you know, what do you call the war? I call it the unnecessary war, because he's making a point that he was right and Chamberlain was wrong, of course. But it's really only from the perspective of 1945 can people start to look back and put these things together and say, and of course the immediate impact, A.J.P. Taylor, I think I mentioned him and did finish the point, but of course in the early 60s, he argues that Hitler is a sort of, I think, calls him wicked but rational.
Yes, he's that's exactly what he calls it. Dictator. He's wicked but rational. He's sort of true, and he fits the kind of bill of what's going to happen and what opportunities he's given, and it's all kind of, I mean, it was a scandalous interpretation of events when he came out with it.
And it was a scandalous interpretation of events, but it actually puts together the First and Second World War.
Yeah,
really nicely. Yeah. But of course, since then, I mean, two of I think the best historians to deal with this are Sir Michael Howard, who was very sadly died last year, and Philip Bell, PMH Bell, who actually also died not that long ago. Around the same time in the mid 90s, they both made separately the same argument that actually, no, Hitler was a one-off. You know, he was such against the run of play that if Hitler had not had come along, you could easily have seen the First World War succeeded by a sort of peace broken by local wars, but nothing on the scale of the Second World War. Hitler made the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that really is where my views lie on this idea of a 30 years war. Yeah, it works really well in some ways, but you mustn't see the Second World War as a direct consequence of the Treaty of Versailles.
Right. Wonderful.
Not a foregone conclusion. It's fascinating.
No.
Yeah. Thank you, Gary. We got... You know what we did there, James, which we rarely do, is we ended up back where we started.
That's amazing, isn't it? So, we should congratulate ourselves on that. But that was fascinating, Gary. And
thank you so much, Gary. Yeah,
and I let you get away with the kind of the British were crap and didn't work out how to use tanks. But maybe
No. I did not say that. I said elements of it were.
No. I'm only joking. But maybe we can discuss that one another time.
Can I just say, apropos, I do not think the British are in the Second World War. War was crap, far from it.
I know.
I share an office with Professor John Buckley, kicking me out if he thought I believed that.
Well, thank you, Gary. And can I just remind everyone again that we've got this the Chalk Valley History Show on tonight with Al talking about his Spitfire bit. And that, also Adam Rutherford and Living History and all sorts of things. So that is on, if you go to cvhf.org.uk, you can see that live on YouTube Premiere at 7:30 p.m. or thereafter tomorrow.
And Gary, you're writing about the Dominion soldiers in the Second World War, aren't you? Their experiences.
I'm writing a book called "Civilian Soldiers: The Experience of British and Dominion Soldiers in Two World Wars." So I'm comparing the First War and Second World War, and the Brits with all the Dominions. So, no pressure. Nice small task.
Exactly. Where do you start?
When can we expect that? When will that appear in my Kindle?
I'm hoping to get the first draft finished by the end of the year. So I've got my teeth into it now, and
when it's up on its legs properly, come and talk to us again, please, and we'd love to hear your findings on that. It'd be brilliant. Well, thank you to Gary Sheffield. Thanks everyone for listening. Cheerio, everybody. I'm a splitter. I'm not a lumper.
Cheerio.
Okay, thank you. Bye.